I am Scott, part of the CA Jail Outreach Digital Team. It is important to understand the foundation of today's discussion. As CEO, David Averitt says, we are under grace no matter what. God gives us the choice between right and wrong. If we choose wrong, we deal with mankind and the law. If we select items that harm our bodies, that is our fault. God never created things to destroy us. We did. This podcast and memoir may not sit well with everyone. If you teach one direction, that is fantastic. But our CEO will never call out people by names. That is not who he is. Today, he talks about grace and love from God. How can you go wrong with that? The CEO will address the elephant in the room, the church giving. It is not a curse if you don't do it. We give freely from the heart as our way of saying thank you to God. So, if God does not curse or punish us anymore, why live like Christians? Why go to church, read our Bible, pray, or give? This is a good question to ask while listening. David said we do these things to show the wonderful light of God. But listen closely. We do not do this to get a blessing. We do this to say thank you for what he did for us. The best way to put it is this: God healed 10 lepers, and only one came back to say thank you. David said in his memoir that he wants to be the one who comes back to say thank you. I do that by doing everything I can, reading, praying, giving, and speaking to be the light for him. Please keep Galatians 3:13 in your thoughts. I heard our boss say this: we serve him not because we are afraid of the dark, but because we are so thankful for the light. We have a saying here: before I turn it over to Trinity and Steve, we don't say goodbye, we say, until the trumpet blows. In the meantime, let's push forward until he comes. God bless you.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are here to serve as your expert guides, cutting through the noise, stacking up the insights from provided material, and making sure you are thoroughly informed quickly. I'm part of the CA Jail Outreach Digital Community Team.
And I'm here to help unpack this incredible material for you, our dedicated listener. We're so glad you've joined us for this really unique exploration.
Absolutely. Today we are doing a deep dive titled Growth Journey, a Deep Dive Podcast. And the reason this is so important is that it's based entirely on a personal and, well, profound memoir written by our CEO and founder, David Averitt.
It's a fantastic piece of work. And, you know, producing the content this way, in this kind of conversational format, it allows the CEO, David, more time to focus on his other massive responsibilities.
Right.
We're talking operational leadership, strategic expansion for CA Jail Outreach nationwide. This format lets his philosophy reach a much wider audience without, you know, pulling him away from the front lines.
That's the whole mission, isn't it? It's about efficiency and impact. And what really defines that philosophy, what just shines through every page of this memoir, is the CEO's core motivation.
His heart for people.
Exactly. His deep, passionate heart for people, especially those impacted by the justice system and, so crucially, the children with loved ones who are currently incarcerated. He's really offering a guide here, a map forged from a lifetime of service.
And what a unique background that map is drawn from. I mean, let's just quickly profile the author here. David Averitt spent 22 years as a combat veteran.
22 years.
Right. And he brings over 40 years of dedicated Bible knowledge and has sustained a marriage for more than 30 years. That combination of military discipline, scriptural wisdom, and relational longevity is just so rare.
And here's a crucial clarification we want to make right at the top. Throughout his military service, Mr. Averitt was a military leader and a combat veteran. He was not a military chaplain.
That's a key distinction.
It is. He is currently a chaplain in the jail system, leading CA Jail Outreach. So he brings that kind of battlefield strategy to the spiritual fight for grace.
And that strategist discipline is what allows him to approach these traditional faith concepts and, you know, challenge them when they no longer serve people. His ultimate goal with this memoir is fundamentally simple, but profound.
What's that?
To change the view of the Christian life, to move it away from being strictly doctrinal or fear-based toward one that's defined entirely by love and grace.
That reframing is everything. And Chaplain David states his mission statement so clearly right at the beginning of the memoir. He says, and I'm quoting here, "Our number one goal is to show the light to others, help them get saved, and show them how a person can give God's light in life."
That really sets the stage for our entire conversation today.
It does. Okay, let's unpack this.
So if we look at that mission statement, showing the light, we have to first analyze the environment we're trying to shine in. And the memoir opens by noting a very visible and difficult trend.
The numbers.
Churches and faith-based organizations are seeing decreasing numbers compared to 5, 10, even 50 years ago. And the big question is, why?
Well, the fundamental observation by the CEO is that the methods are outdated. He observes that many leaders today are trying to be, in his words, duplicates of pioneers who belong to a vastly different era.
Right. You can't solve a 21st century digital problem with a mid-20th century analog methodology.
The friction there is just immense.
And that friction isn't just organizational, it's theological. The boss points out that leaders often cling to teachings about God's wrath or strict obedience, even though the New Testament overwhelmingly emphasizes love and grace.
Okay, so the foundation for this new approach rests on that theological truth.
Mm-hmm. The idea that God's wrath is essentially absent for the believer because, as he says, the price has already been paid through the death of Christ.
Wait, that's a massive claim. So if we truly believe that Christ paid the price in full, why is the default setting in so many churches still fear? Why the emphasis on a wrathful God just waiting to catch you out?
I think it speaks to the power of tradition. You know, it often overrides clear scriptural mandates. Chaplain David argues that this disconnect between the guaranteed freedom of the new covenant and the fear-based control of the old covenant law is what's pushing people away.
Especially younger generations.
Especially them. They see a God of love taught one moment and then a God of rigid judgment preached the next. It feels inconsistent.
That feeling of being stuck in old-fashioned ways that Mr. Everett mentions really hits home. Especially when you contrast the old media landscape with the current digital era. It's a total transformation.
Oh, the contrast is phenomenal. And it really helps you understand the scope of the challenge. I mean, think about how we used to consume media. If you wanted to buy something, you waited for the Sears catalog to arrive.
And your choices were limited to, what, 20 pages?
Exactly. And now you have Amazon offering billions of products instantly.
Or think about the spiritual landscape. In the past, you tuned into a physical radio station and you listened to the same few syndicated preachers all day because, well, those were the only voices available.
And the memoir captures this perfectly. There's a quote. Now, you type a keyword into Spotify and you have over 1,000 preachers to choose from.
1,000. And it's not just that. It's 5,000 social media influencers tracking 5,000 plus viewers right now. The narrative is no longer controllable by one centralized source.
You can instantly compare messages, which is why the CEO insists, this is another quote, churches need to change things up. What we did years ago will not work today. The competition for attention and really authenticity is monumental.
And this authenticity challenge leads to another important caution the house gives, the caution against speaking outside one's age brackets or experience brackets. He challenges leaders who rely only on what dad told me to do, but they lack that real life practical experience.
This is all about credibility. He gives this sharp example of a young preacher trying to teach a detailed series on marriage after only being married for 3 years.
Right. No children, living in a rental apartment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's not saying the young leader lacks zeal, but that their advice, however scripturally sound it might be, it just lacks the wisdom that's forged in the fires of long-term commitment and family stress.
So he's not trying to silence younger voices. He's asking them to ground their teaching in genuine, applicable wisdom that's gained through experience, to speak inside your age bracket.
Precisely. His background as a military leader means he values strategy that's forged in reality. He expects others to use their own life's wisdom, their trials, their successes, their failures, to offer advice that truly has weight.
Which is exactly what people are looking for in the digital age. Authentic, experienced guidance. Oh. So if we're going to be effective, we need to distinguish between what's essential faith and what's just inherited tradition.
Right.
Let's dive into that distinction now in the section titled The Heart of Worship, Distinguishing Tradition from Truth.
This deep dive into origins is so crucial because it really gives the learner permission to let go of the non-essentials. Let's start with the most standardized tradition of all, the church building itself.
Yeah. The memoir notes that the biblical reality is that early Christians met in house churches. Acts 2 verse 46 in the King James Version says, "And they, continuing daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house."
So private homes, decentralized.
Exactly. So where did the standardized, you know, long aisle cathedral-like structure even come from?
Well, the historical origin is pure adaptation. After Christianity was legalized in the Roman Empire, around 313 AD, believers needed larger spaces for the growing crowds. So they moved into existing Roman government buildings called basilicas.
A basilica? That was like a public hall for law courts and commerce, right?
That's it. And when the church adopted it, they inherited the architecture. The long aisles, the high ceilings, the raised platform at the end. We still see that structure today, thousands of years later, because of a real estate decision made in the 4th century.
That's incredible. Okay, what about the pulpit?
The biblical reality is that Jesus often taught while seated. That was the traditional posture for a rabbi. Luke 4, verse 20 tells us that after reading the scroll, Jesus closed the book and sat down, and the eyes of all them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him.
The focus was on the teacher, not the platform.
Right. The pulpit's historical origin evolved from the ambo, which was a raised reading stand. It was just functional. It helped project the reader's voice over a crowd in those giant basilicas.
The closest Old Testament reference, I think the memoir notes, is Nehemiah 8, verse 4.
Right, where Ezra stood upon a pulpit of wood. It was a tool for acoustic necessity, not some mandatory spiritual fixture.
Okay, let's move to the choir, often front and center.
The biblical reality for the New Testament church emphasizes congregational participatory singing. Ephesians 5, verse 19 is the key text. Speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord.
The audience is God and one another.
Exactly. The modern performance dynamic, where you have a dedicated group leading from a special area, that really traces its historical origin back to the Old Testament Levitical priesthood.
Ah, okay. 1 Chronicles 15, verse 27.
That's the one. It was tied to temple ritual. We've often inherited that specialized performance structure, even though the New Testament calls for widespread reciprocal participation.
And finally, the standard predictable order of service we see today.
Right, the sequence of hymns, announcements, sermon.
Early worship was spontaneous. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 26 describes it as, when ye come together, every one of you hath a psalm, hath a doctrine. It was fluid, participatory.
The historical origin for the structured sequence came when the crowds grew too large for spontaneity. Leaders just adopted the orderly structure of the Jewish synagogue to maintain control. It was just organizational efficiency.
So the takeaway is simple. None of these things, the building, the pulpit, the choir, the order, none of them are mandated by God. They're just inherited adaptations.
Exactly. Which brings us to the next big question. If all those things are tradition, what are the non-negotiables?
This section of the memoir clarifies the few ingredients that are actually mandated by the Bible. These are the four ordinances or essentials.
First up is doctrine or teaching. We are commanded to read and teach the Word of God. Acts 2, verse 42, establishes the pattern. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, and in breaking of bread and in prayers.
It's the spiritual food a believer needs to grow.
Second is fellowship. And this isn't just polite conversation. It's deep mutual encouragement. We are commanded not to isolate ourselves.
Which is why Hebrews 10, verse 25 warns us not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together.
Right. Fellowship is that mutual support system you need to sustain faith when things get tough.
Third, the breaking of bread or communion. This is the constant anchor, the visible reminder of grace. Luke 22, verse 19 records Jesus instructing them to this do in remembrance of me.
It keeps the cross central. And the fourth essential is prayer. We're called to be a house of worship where active communication with God is paramount. 1 Timothy 2, verse 8 gives the directive for the gathering.
I will therefore that men pray everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So those four things, teaching, fellowship, communion, and prayer, are the heart of the gathering. Everything else is just secondary decoration.
And this leads to the crucial realization in part three, our freedom in Christ, the container. The Bible is surprisingly silent on how we execute those four essentials.
The only rule, as Mr. Everett reminds us, is that it must be done decently and in order, according to 1 Corinthians 14, verse 40.
That organizational freedom is so liberating, it means the physical location is irrelevant.
Absolutely. Acts 17, verse 24 says that God dwelleth not in temples made with hands. We can meet in a park, a warehouse, a home. The structure doesn't define his presence.
And neither does outward appearance. The style of music, the clothes, the stage design, all secondary. 1 Samuel 16, verse 7 grounds this. Nehemiah looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart.
The culture of the church should adapt to reach the community, not just cling to an inherited style. And the final encouragement here from John 4, verses 23 and 24, is the ultimate freedom clause.
What's that?
True worship is not about external ritual or style. It's about worshiping the Father in spirit and in truth. The boss is basically giving us permission to let go of the historical baggage so we can focus all our energy on what really matters.
So if we strip away the non-essentials, what does the church have to look like to be effective in 2025 and beyond? This next section, the vision for the church in 2025, a blueprint for God's people in a changing world, gives us that answer.
It's a beautifully balanced blueprint. It's divided into what Chaplain David calls the heart of the church and the hands of the church. These six functions define how CAJL Outreach approaches its mission.
Let's start with the heart. Function number one is non-negotiable: teaching and living love. In a world that's so polarized, love has to be the first thing people see.
It's the brand identifier. Jesus said it in John 13, verse 35, "By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another." If they don't see love first, they won't stick around for the doctrine.
And it has to be a powerful love. 1 Peter 4, verse 8 describes it as fervent charity, which shall cover the multitude of sins.
That implies this intense, purposeful love that just chooses to overlook minor offenses to maintain unity.
Okay, function number two is showing grace to the broken. This is so crucial for our work. The church must be a hospital for the broken, not a showroom for perfect lives.
Right. The world is addicted to judgment. The church must offer unconditional acceptance. And the theology backs it up. Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9.
"For by grace are ye saved through faith. It is the gift of God, not of works."
So if our salvation is a pure gift, our community should operate the same way, as a gift freely given, without demanding people clean themselves up first.
And that's the power of the throne of grace from Hebrews 4, verse 16. We approach it boldly,
not because we're perfect, but because we're imperfect and we desperately need help.
And function number three, being the light in darkness. This is the outward mandate. As the world feels more confused and chaotic, the church has to shine brighter.
Matthew 5, verses 14 through 16 defines it: "Ye are the light of the world. We shine not by screaming condemnation, but by demonstrating good works."
So the heart of the church is love, grace, and light. Now the practical application, the hands of the church.
Function number four is being a pillar of truth or stability. In an age where everything seems to be relative truth, the church has to be the stable, immovable foundation.
The anchor people need. 1 Timothy 3, verse 15 calls the church the pillar and ground of the truth. That stability is what attracts people when everything else is chaos.
And truth is practical liberation. John 8, verses 31 to 32 promise that ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Truth breaks bondage.
Function number five, a training center or discipleship. This is where Chaplain David's military background really comes through.
Mm-hmm. The church isn't a waiting room for heaven. It's a rigorous training ground. The leaders are there to equip. Ephesians 4, verses 11 and 12 says the purpose of leaders is for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry.
Every believer is meant to be trained to do the work. It's rooted in the Great Commission.
And function number six, which is so vital today, is a family for the lonely, or fellowship. Loneliness is a genuine epidemic. The church has to function as a spiritual family.
This is so practical for our organization. Losing a loved one to incarceration often means losing your whole community. We have to be that replacement family. Galatians 6, verse 2, "Bear ye one another's burdens."
It's the divine design. Psalm 68, verse 6 says, "God setteth the solitary in families. For a child or spouse left alone after an arrest, that stable, non-judgmental family unit is life-saving."
And the CEO, Mr. Averitt, wraps this all up with a quote that just encapsulates the whole vision.
What quote is that?
"The church is not a museum for saints to stand in, but a hospital for sinners to heal in and a school for disciples to grow in."
That just shifts the focus entirely from performance to growth and healing, which leads us to the theological core of this entire memoir, God's one-way street, why he sends blessings, not curses.
This is a big one. This challenges that transactional old covenant view of faith that so many believers are still stuck in.
We're talking about confronting the strict scorecard mentality.
Yeah.
You know, the belief that if you get a flat tire, it must be because you missed your devotion.
That God is punishing you.
Right. And that framework creates endless anxiety. The core truth David Everett presents is that God is a one-direction God. He doesn't flip a switch between bless and curse.
And the anchor for that.
1 John 1, verse 5. "God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. If his nature is pure light, he cannot, by his very nature, send curses to his children."
That is a fundamental paradigm shift. But
he has had to deal with our mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we still make them, and sometimes the consequences feel like punishment.
They do, and that's where we have to make the critical distinction between divine punishment and divine chastisement.
Okay, break that down.
The legal foundation is that the curse is broken. Punishment, the retribution for our failure, was handled entirely by Jesus on the cross. Galatians 3, verse 13 provides the legal proof.
Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us.
So God cannot judge the believer for their sin. The judgment has already been executed on the substitute. The debt is paid. To punish us now would be double jeopardy.
So because that debt is paid, God now relates to us as a loving father, not a judge.
Exactly. Therefore, he practices chastisement, which is training or correction designed for growth. It's disciplinary, not punitive. Hebrews 12, verses 6 and 11 define this. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth.
And it explains that afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness. The goal is positive. It's about refinement, not rejection.
Okay, so we've established God doesn't curse the believer. But what about someone who is unsaved and actively living in defiance of God? Does God curse them?
The answer from the memoir is nuanced but clear. No. Legally, they are condemned already, as John 3, verse 18 says, because they haven't accepted the payment. But God doesn't actively curse their daily life on earth.
Instead, they receive what he calls common grace.
Yes. Common grace is God's general benevolence extended to all humanity, regardless of their belief. It's the kindness and patience of God. Matthew 5, verse 45 gives the definitive evidence.
He maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust.
That's a staggering truth. The person who actively rebels against God is still allowed to enjoy sunshine, family, a good job, unearned joy.
But there is a real danger, isn't there? The memoir talks about the giving them over concept.
Yes. This is terrifying. From Romans 1, verse 24, if an unsaved person persistently ignores God, the real rejection isn't a lightning bolt. It's God removing his protective, restraining hand.
So, God gives them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts.
It's the ultimate consequence on earth, the terrifying freedom of being left completely alone with your own destructive impulses. God isn't actively punishing, he's honoring their choice to be self-directed.
Let's apply this one-way street concept to tithing. If a believer doesn't give 10%, does the CEO maintain that God curses them?
Definitely not. The key is understanding the difference between the Malachi curse versus the cross. Malachi 3 was Old Covenant law. Those curses were paid for by Christ.
So we transition our thinking to giving under grace. We don't give to avoid a curse. We give out of love and gratitude.
2 Corinthians 9, verse 7 is the standard. Not grudgingly or of necessity. For God loveth a cheerful giver. Fear is explicitly disqualified as a motivation.
Okay, so if I don't give generously, I'm not cursed. But what happens instead?
The memoir reframes it through sowing and reaping. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 6 says, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly. It's an agricultural principle.
Not a curse.
Not a curse. If a farmer only plants a handful of seeds, he gets a tiny harvest. He hasn't been cursed. He just limited his own potential return. It reframes giving as an act of trust, not a tax, to avoid God's wrath.
This finally allows us to challenge what the memoir calls lazy theology, the idea that every bad thing happens because you are out of God's will.
It's such a relief for people who blame themselves for every tragedy. Chaplain David reminds us that bad things just happen. We live in a broken, fallen world.
Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11. Time and chance happeneth to them all.
Right. Not every illness or car accident is a spiritual judgment. Sometimes it's just bad luck in a fallen world. We have to stop spiritualizing every catastrophe.
And this brings us to the famous Job's friend's mistake.
When Job lost everything, his religious friends insisted, Job, you must have sinned. God is punishing you.
And they were wrong. God was angry with them later because their strict scorecard theology was inaccurate and, frankly, cruel.
Exactly. They misidentified the author of the pain. The memoir stresses that God is the author of the solution, not the problem. Romans 8, verse 28 confirms this. All things work together for good to them that love God.
He takes the tragic ingredients of a fallen world and weaves them into a good outcome. That's the definition of the one-way street.
It is. Which brings us to the practical application of this. A field guide to freedom.
Right. Breaking the chains of fear by deconstructing the lies. Let's get into the 27 statements Mr. Averett outlines, contrasting the misuse with the context and truth.
This is so important for the families we serve who are already under immense strain. Let's start with a big one. Lie one, the tithing curse.
Okay, the lie states, if you do not tithe, you are inviting a curse. The misused verse is Malachi 3.
And the context and truth, as we said, is that Malachi was old covenant law. Galatians 3 verse 13 confirms Christ took the curse. Giving is voluntary and cheerful. End of story.
Done. Okay, next up. A lie that protects unaccountable leadership. Lie 3. Questioning leadership.
This one is dangerous, the statement. Questioning the pastor or leadership is the same as attacking God's anointed. They cite Psalm 105 verse 15. Touch not mine anointed.
That's classic context abuse, isn't it?
Totally. That psalm referred to the entire nation of Israel. It was never a shield for a modern leader to avoid accountability. The truth. Acts 17 verse 11 commends the Bereans for questioning the Apostle Paul and checking his claims against Scripture.
Healthy leadership invites questions.
Exactly.
Moving to a lie that heaps guilt on the sick. Lie 6. Sickness and faith.
The damaging lie. If you are sick, it is because you have hidden sin or you simply do not have enough faith. They often point to Isaiah 53, verse 5, with his stripes we are healed.
But the primary context of that verse is spiritual healing, right? The cure for sin.
Yes. The truth is that sickness is primarily a result of a fallen world. If perfect faith guaranteed perfect health, we'd never have funerals for believers. Even Paul had a thorn in the flesh that God chose not to remove.
A huge one next. Lie 8. Generational curses.
This has caused generations of fear. The statement, you are suffering today because of the sins of your ancestors, citing Exodus 20, verse 5.
This places such an intolerable burden on people, especially a child whose father is in jail.
Right. And the context and truth is vital here. Exodus described the natural social consequences of idolatry. But the new covenant completely removes the legal standing of that curse.
Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law.
And Ezekiel 18, verse 20 makes it absolutely clear. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father. The blood of Jesus broke that chain.
Let's talk prayer access. Lie 20. God not hearing.
The statement, God does not hear your prayers because your sin has separated you from him. This uses Isaiah 59, verse 2.
The context and truth is that Isaiah was addressing unrepentant national Israel. For the believer, Romans 8, verses 38 and 39 assures us nothing can separate us from the love of God.
So sin doesn't sever the relationship?
No. But it definitely impacts the fellowship. It puts static on the line, makes us feel distant. But the permanent connection is secure. Confession restores the intimacy.
Okay, a lie that creates so much confusion during loss.
Yeah.
Lie 21, the God caused it lie.
God took your loved one or caused this tragedy to teach you a lesson.
And they sometimes quote Job.
But Job spoke those words in the immediate shock of grief before he understood the full picture. The New Testament is explicit. Death is an enemy. God is the redeemer who brings good out of tragedy, not the author of it.
Let's do the fear of losing your spiritual foundation. Lie 23, the lost anointing lie.
The fear, if you don't feel God's presence, the Holy Spirit has left you. This relies on David's prayer in Psalm 51.
A critical misunderstanding of the covenants. David prayed that under the old covenant where the Spirit could depart. New covenant promise in John 14, verse 16, is that the Comforter abides with us forever.
We are sealed.
Sealed. He may be grieved, but he does not leave.
Finally, a lie that keeps many trapped in toxic situations. Lie 27, the marriage lesson lie.
So dangerous. Your marriage is out of whack because God is trying to teach you a patience lesson.
The context in truth is that God is not the author of confusion. Toxic marriages are the result of human choice, selfishness, and a failure to apply grace. Blaming God prevents people from taking responsibility and seeking real practical help.
When we deconstruct these lies, we step out of bondage.
Yeah.
As Chaplain David concludes this section, he says, when we stop blaming God for the consequences of our own choices, we finally gain the power to make better choices. Grace is not an excuse to stay broken. It is the power to rebuild.
That is the core takeaway of the entire memoir. God operates on a one-way street. He sends goodness freely. And David Averett uses two perfect analogies to synthesize this whole message.
Let's start with the prodigal son, Luke 15. It's the clearest illustration of the difference between enjoying the relationship and having the relationship guaranteed.
First, the son who stayed, the older brother. This is the believer walking in obedience. He's not earning the father's love, but he's enjoying the father's abundance and peace every single day.
He has access to the king's resources.
Exactly. Now, consider the son who left the prodigal. He represents the believer living in sin. The father still loved him. 2 Timothy 2, verse 13, he abideth faithful. The relationship was guaranteed.
But the tragedy is that the son was miserable, starving, living in a pig pen, all while having guaranteed access to the king's unlimited resources back home.
His misery was a direct consequence of his own choices, not the father cursing him.
The father was just watching the road, waiting to restore the enjoyment of that connection, which leads to the radio station analogy.
Right. Think of God's grace as a powerful radio station, perpetually broadcasting love, blessing, and peace 24/7.
Our spiritual disciplines, prayer, church, Bible reading, they aren't payment. They are simply the act of tuning the dial to hear the music. When you tune in, you download his peace and joy.
The broadcast was always there, but now you can hear it clearly.
And when we sin or drift away, that is tuning the dial to static. We haven't destroyed the station. God is still broadcasting. But we have chosen to tune our own dial to a miserable frequency.
The confusion and anxiety is the static we introduced, not God stopping the broadcast.
So the profound summary is this. Obedience allows you to enjoy the relationship. Grace guarantees you keep the relationship.
And that guarantee, that anchor, is Romans 8, verses 38 and 39. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God.
And we can wrap up with that final quote from Chaplain David, which brings the whole message home.
Religion tries to create a two-way trade with God, buying blessings with good behavior. But grace is a one-way street. God sends his goodness down freely, and the only thing that goes back up is our gratitude.
That is a powerful, freeing conclusion. And it leaves us with something to really think about, this one-way street concept, that God only sends good pain. It radically changes how you view pain.
How so?
Well, if God is the author of the solution, not the problem, how does this change the way you pray for others who are suffering? We should stop asking him why he caused the pain and start asking him what beautiful resolution he is working to bring out of it.
That is a hopeful and challenging thought to internalize, and a perfect place to close this deep dive. Thank you for walking us through this growth journey and distilling the heart of David Averett's transformative memoir.
My pleasure. We hope this has provided the quick, thorough knowledge you, the learner, were looking for, delivered in a way that feels clear and accessible.
And thank you, CA Jail Outreach, for hosting this deep dive and for your dedication to sharing hope and truth to inmates, their families, and especially the children impacted by the justice system. We encourage you to ignite your own journey of hope and growth.
You can explore the vital work of CA Jail Outreach via the link in the description. You'll find resources for families, opportunities for praying hearts, and ways to request a chaplain for an incarcerated loved one.
And for a deeper look at everything we discussed today, the full memoir is available on their site under The Grow. Listen, watch, tab.
Finally, we have to thank David, the CEO and founder, specifically for sharing his heart and his profound wisdom through this memoir, paving the way for a deeper understanding of grace for all of us.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until the trumpet blows, wishing you a fantastic day.
Thank you so much for tuning in with us today. If anything we discussed raised a question for you, please don't hesitate to reach out. You can find the link to our website right down in the description box. From there, you can connect with us through chat, email, or social media. On a personal note, if you are listening and feel you don't have that sense of grace in your heart yet, I encourage you to just open your web browser and type in how to get saved. And finally, if you just need to talk to someone directly, please know that we are here for you. The CEO always says this: helping is ordinary, adding ice makes it extraordinary. There are leaders, and then there are leaders who serve, but among the best are those who always remember to add ice. Have a great day.